This is day five of the 2006 Idlewild Bible School. Our third period teacher is Brother James Mansfield. His general topic is Those Who Overcame. And today's topic is Manasseh.
Good morning, brothers and sisters. Well, this morning we're going to look at Manasseh, and I hope we're going to find him just as interesting as the other people that we've looked at. Now, I am going to have to be a nuisance. Do you mind if that air conditioner does go off? I'm freezing. Okay, we all know the story, and that's the good thing. We all know the background, so we really only have to look at the highlights, how that Hezekiah was granted another 15 years of life, and 3 years later, Manasseh was born. What's the meaning of Manasseh's name? You forget? Actually, that's what it means. Forgetting. Why on earth would Hezekiah call the son's name forgetting? Everyone's slow this morning. I thought you all had a coffee. Exactly. Hopefully, by this boy, he would forget all his troubles and his sickness. And indeed, it was a very, very dreadful sickness. All right, now we read of the reign of Manasseh in 2 Kings 21 and at verse 1. 2 Kings 21 and at verse 1, it says, Manasseh was 12 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned for 55 years in Jerusalem. Now, you would expect that this reign could have been one of the best reigns of all. It was a time of prosperity. The Assyrians had been dealt a very serious blow, so therefore the Assyrians kept away for quite some time. Manasseh was blessed with a long life and with great health. You would expect this would be one of the best of all the kingdoms. He had a fantastic father. But he was the worst of all the kings of Judah. The big question, and this is the important issue that we're going to look at, what went wrong? What do you think? What went wrong? He was 12 years old when his father died. He had every opportunity, but something drastically went wrong. What was it? Any ideas? What went wrong with the rain? Yes. Okay, the suggestion there is perhaps it's Hezekiah's fault. Now, in case we're thinking that the preparation of Manasseh wasn't okay, come across to 2 Chronicles 31. There's some people who say, look, Hezekiah was so busy in the last 15 years of his life, he neglected his son. Wasn't enough time for the family. Brothers and sisters, I'm suggesting that is not correct, and I'll show you why. 2 Chronicles 31, verse 21. 2 Chronicles 31, verse 21, it gets to the end of Hezekiah's life. And notice this, in every work that he began in the service of the house of God and in the law and in the commandments to seek his God, he did it with all his heart and prospered. Now, if we're saying one of the most important works of preparing Manasseh was not done right, that disagrees with that verse, because in every work he began and he finished it. And in actual fact, that is a hallmark of the reign of Hezekiah. He was a man who was obsessed with finishing a work that he began. Come back to chapter 29. Get out your pencils. There's a couple of verses that I want you to underline, or a phrase that I want you to underline. 2 Chronicles 29 and at verse 17, Hezekiah was a man who had very clear goals. Verse 17, he begun them, circle that, and then at the end of the verse, he finished it. Again in verse 27, here's another work, and you'll notice right in the middle of the verse, he began that work. At the end of verse 28, he finished it. Again, that's emphasized in verse 2, he made an end of it. Chapter 29, verse 34, halfway through the verse, he ended it. Come to the next chapter, chapter 31. When all this was finished, put a circle around that word. He's got a new work in verse 7. He begun that work and he finished that work. Therefore, okay, I agree, as the questioner has said, or the person who came up with that answer has said, Hezekiah made his mistakes. But if he had a work, he was absolutely vital that he would finish the work that he begun. And therefore, that's exactly what he did with Manasseh. Manasseh had the best preparation possible. His father did everything he could to get him to love God. He encouraged him to read, to study, to meditate. He gave him confidence that the word of God was correct. He showed him how to love his brethren and sisters. And when he left him at 12 years old, he could not have had a better preparation. Okay, so therefore, we're suggesting this boy of 12 years old could have the best preparation possible. Where did he go wrong? Possibly. Be nice to blame the sisters, but I don't think so. Possibly. I think a key is in chapter 21 and at verse 3. It makes a comparison between Manasseh and Ahab. He did these things as Ahab did. Again in verse 13, God is going to punish them with the plummet of the house of Ahab. And there's a comparison being made between Manasseh and Ahab. Where did Ahab go wrong? He was seduced away from the truth by someone in an influential position, and I would suggest the same thing happened to Manasseh. Someone, and I don't know who because the scripture does not say, but someone in an influential position seduced him from the truth. What a tragedy. There's a 13-year-old boy at his father's funeral crying his eyes out. He's a young boy who his father did everything he could to prepare him for when he was gone. And there is someone or a group of people in the crowd saying, I'm lucky that little boy is so young. We're going to do everything we can to bring him under our evil influence. It was someone or a group of people who hated the fact that under Hezekiah things had been so strict. We prefer that you're allowed to do what you like and have fun with the pagan ceremonies, and that's what we want to do in the kingdom. All right, if that's the case, and you want to corrupt a 12-year-old boy from the truth, what would you do? You got a 12-year-old, I don't like the truth anymore. I want to corrupt him from the truth. How would you do that with a 12-year-old boy? I'm going to suggest there's three ways. And the adults had better get this, because the teenagers certainly did. That's putting the pressure on, isn't it? How would you seduce a 12... Does everyone understand what I'm talking about? If you don't, nod your head, because it makes me feel better. Right, someone wants to seduce him from the truth. Someone in a position of authority. How are you going to do it? Sorry? Give him what he wants. But as a 12-year-old, perhaps he doesn't... That's true, I don't disagree with that. But as a 12-year-old, he perhaps doesn't realise what he wants. Okay, so you would encourage him to indulge in idolatry. What else would you do? If you want someone to leave the truth. Sorry? Okay, build up his pride. Okay, yep, okay. Yep. There's now four. What would you do? Sorry? Yep. Exactly. You would destroy his confidence in the Bible, and there's something else you do that is linked to that point. Okay, but that's not their job to correct him. It's their job to seduce him. Okay, that would fit in as far as parents are concerned. He's a 12-year-old boy. His dad's just died. How would he think about his dad? What would he think of his dad? What do most 12-year-old boys think of their dad? They love him. So if you want to seduce him away from the truth, what are you going to have to do? You're going to have to destroy his confidence in his father. And I believe that's exactly what this person or group of people did. If we're following the pattern of Ahab, he was seduced away from the truth by someone in an influential position. The very first thing they would do is say, look, You know, the Bible's a good book, but the prophets aren't always correct. What they'd say would be nonsense, but they'd say, you know, Isaiah talked about the fact that Assyria would be totally wiped out. Manasseh, has that happened? I suppose not. Isaiah also talked about the golden age of the kingdom, where the lion will lay down with the lamb. Has that happened, Manasseh? I suppose not. Can you see what they did very cleverly? They put doubt in his mind. Maybe the truth isn't what it's made out to be. And then as far as his father was concerned, they'd say, look, your father was a tremendous fellow. I don't disagree with that. But you've got to admit there are other gods. I don't disagree. Yahweh is the God of Israel, but there are other gods that the kings of Judah worshipped. One of your great kings is King Solomon. Go up to the top of Mount of Olives and you'll see all sorts of temples there. And he was successful. Manasseh, your dad was a tremendous brother. He did so many good things in the truth, but I think he was too strict. I think that's why the trouble came upon him. And therefore, Manasseh, I think you should think about worshipping other idols. And so therefore, he started to introduce him to idolatry. Now look, he's a 12-year-old boy. He would be worried. This is going against what my dad said. But they start to bring doubt in. And they would actively encourage him to go along to the meeting. We're not saying that, Manasseh. Keep going along to the meeting. But just try some of these other things. And can you imagine for a 12-year-old boy, he would go to some of the other worship. He'd start to see some nice dancing, some really good music. Wow, this is different to what I hear in the worship of Yahweh. From a 12-year-old boy's perspective, the worship of Yahweh would be fairly boring. Go along, there's music, there's dancing. Then he starts to see nudity. As he gets a bit older, he starts to see immorality in front of him. And then when you're sick of that, then you can go and worship Molech, where there's a bit of violence and murder. And in the end, he's indulging in all of these things. You know, the great tragedy is a 12 to 15-year-old boy got a taste for it. He got a taste for these darker things. And the more he saw, the more he wanted. And these princes were enormously successful because at 18 years old, he was a total idolater and he approved and loved every single worship of all the nations around. Any new worship? Yes, come in and establish it in my kingdom. And so tragically, because of that, this young boy never ever developed a relationship with God because these princes said it's a waste of time. You don't want to worship that sort of God. He is a stern, vindictive God who wants to stop you having fun. Go and worship these other things. That's where your fun will be. And so we've got the progress report of this young boy who started off with a brilliant preparation, but things got worse. As you go through 2 Kings 21 at verse 1, you'll notice in verse 2, he did evil. That's worth underlining. At the end of verse 6, he increased in evil. And in verse 9, he multiplied evil. It got worse and worse and worse. And you think, what a tragedy that these princes seduced this young boy from the truth. Brothers and sisters, this is where it gets very powerful for us. I believe all of us here are just like Hezekiah and Hephzibah. Every single brother and sister here, every single parent here does everything they can to develop godliness in their children. We encourage our children to read, to pray, to study, to preach, to show love to their brethren and sisters. Yet I really do believe that wonderful work can be destroyed if we allow outside influences to seduce our children. And my words are to parents, to grandparents, to anyone in the ecclesia, because you can do this. You can seduce our children. Brothers and sisters, particularly parents, are you following the pattern of the princes in what you're allowing your children to see? And I must say that the remarks that I'm about to make is based on what's happening at home, right? Please accept that. I do not know what's happening here in North America. And so therefore the words I'm about to say are based on what we've got at home, and what I'm saying to you is exactly what I would say back home. But in our youth group, I'm surprised what 12 to 15-year-old boys talk about. they tell their friends what they've seen the night before. And in some cases, it seems that parents will allow their children to watch anything. And I am just absolutely shattered when I go away from a meeting to realise that there are 12 to 15-year-old boys who are actively allowed to watch films that are filled with nudity, immorality, violence, and murder. And that's not all. We've now got the internet. There is the potential in your home for your children to see absolute graphic immorality. I can't say whether it's a problem here, but I can assure you back home it is a huge problem. And if you don't believe me, ask your young people. Because the young people, it's one of the rare cases where the young people are that shattered and that worried about it. The young people are going to the ABs and say, we have a huge problem. What can we do about it? Brothers and sisters, we need to be so careful. The world's influence is bad enough. You need to limit the way in which the world can seduce your children at home. And you might say, oh, look, that's over the top. Brothers and sisters, I can't particularly speak for the girls. I know I'm in touch with my feminine side, but not to that extent. I am particularly addressing my words to 12 to 15-year-old boys. I tell you what, you only need to see these graphic things only a few times and you'll get a taste for it. Only two or three times you'll get a taste for it, which ends up being an obsession, and it leads to an addiction that can be around for decades. And we're starting to pay the price for when this started 20 years ago, that we're now seeing 30 to 40-year-old brethren who are leaving the truth. It's happening, all right. It's happening and it'll keep happening. Before I left, a brother about my age left a beautiful wife and three children to go with someone else. A month before that, another brother broke up with his wife. And quite often the cause of it is this. Are introduced to immorality, pornography when they are young. They got a taste for it, and it is now an obsession that is just colouring their thought, and we are starting to pay for it. It is the responsibility of everyone in the ecclesia. The children are a great gift from God, and we don't want to lose any of them. There's nothing worse, brothers and sisters, for us to lose a child to the world. And while it's wonderful that we are doing everything we can to positively encourage our children in reading and studying and meditating and showing love to one another, brothers and sisters, we need to do everything we possibly can to stop the world from seducing our children. Back then, they would literally have to get Manasseh and take him outside to go to these idols. Brothers and sisters, you know what I'm about to say. We can bring them into our home. And our young kids can be watching this sort of stuff and can be seduced away from the world, from the truth, in your house. When you're at home, ask yourself, is there things that my children are going to see tonight that is going to help the world to seduce my children? And what a tragedy it was back then, and it will be a tragedy today unless we can limit the effect of the world to seduce our children. And so we've got the tragic story, 2 Kings chapter 21. He's 12 years old when he began to reign. Verse 2, he does the abominations of the heathen. That word means morally disgusting. When you go through verse 2 to 7, you need to see the focus on he. It's worth circling. Verse 2, he. Verse 3, two times. He built, he reared. Verse 4, he built. Verse 5, he built. Verse 6, he made. Again, it's he wrought. Verse 7, he. Can you see what's happening? He was seduced in the first place, but now here's the great innovator. Any new religion, I will accept. If you don't like Molech, you can have Baal. I'll cater to everyone. And there we have it, Baal in verse 3 and a grove. In a sense, it was just a religious excuse for immorality. That's the simple point of going to these temples. Now let's go through it. He built again, verse 3, the high places which his dad destroyed. He reared up altars to Baal. He built altars in verse 4 in the house of God. He built altars for the house of heaven. Verse 6, he made his sons pass through the fire. Any religion he'll incorporate. He observed times, which means he practiced magic. He used enchantments. He whispered magic spells. He dealt with familiar spirits. He makes contact with the dead. He even went to India.
Yes, Manasseh, worship the snake charmers.
That's what a wizard is. You can see how far afield he's going to get any sort of religion. Now, brothers and sisters, when you read through those verses, he's got a big problem. Can you kind of work out what his problem is? Particularly in verse 3. He built again the places which his father destroyed. What's going on in his mind? What's he trying to prove? He's got issues with his father, I believe. The princes had convinced him that his father was wrong, and he's got something to prove. If Dad said this, I'm going the exact opposite. You might say, what a tragedy. I'll tell you what, that's happening today. There are brethren now who are saying, that's what Dad did. If that's what Dad did, I'm going in the opposite direction. What a foolish way to make a decision. Surely all of our decisions should be based on what the Word of God says. If you're saying I'm going the exact opposite way to my father, it's a ridiculous way to go, and it will end up in disaster, just like it ended up in disaster with Manasseh, because he provoked the Lord to anger. God was furious. As it gets worse, instead of stopping, verse 7, he sets up a graven image in the house of God. It would be like putting up a picture of a nude woman in our ecclesial hall. And while I apologise for being so graphic, that's the point. It's the place of God's name in verse 7. It's the place of his holiness. Verse 9, not only did Manasseh refuse to listen, but Israel hearkened not, because Manasseh had seduced them just like he had been seduced, and he multiplies in evil more than the nations whom the Lord destroyed before the children of Israel. You know what, when Joshua came into the promised land, God said, make sure you destroy the people in Canaan. That wasn't necessarily the case in the nations around Canaan. You have to kill the people in Canaan because they are the worst people in the world. And now they're being told, because of the good work of Manasseh, Israel is worse than the worst nation in the whole world. And so God says, I've got to do something. Verse 10, he sends prophets and says, because you are doing these things, in verse 11, God will punish you severely. Now, what does Manasseh do? Verse 16, he says, how dare you stand up against me? I will kill you. And Manasseh, in 2 Kings 21 and at verse 16, shed innocent blood very much till he had filled Jerusalem from one end to the other. In a fit of anger, he has this systematic slaughter of the prophets. How many? I would suggest thousands. Any opposition, any questioning, I will kill you. And there is now in Jerusalem a reign of terror, and blood flowed in the streets of Jerusalem. I tell you what, he was incredibly successful. We all know Isaiah and Micah prophesied in the reign of Hezekiah. The next prophets, Jeremiah and Zephaniah, began their work in the reign of Josiah. Now that is remarkable, because we're getting to the end of Judah's kingdom. And at the end of Judah's kingdom, as God did at the end of Israel's kingdom, he sends prophet after prophet after prophet. But for 55 years, there is no prophet mentioned. For 55 years, a prophet does not write a book of the Bible. Why? Because Manasseh killed the lot of them. But even more than that, it would appear he went from house to house and burned every copy of the law of God. Why do I say that? Why am I suggesting that? You'd better get this one, because the teenager's got this one. Yell it out. Exactly. In the time of Josiah, there was only one copy. How did that occur? I can't prove it, but I'm suggesting that Manasseh destroyed every single copy of the law. You know, why is this man so obsessed? I would suggest he knew he was doing the wrong thing, but he kept going. You know, we're following a pattern, aren't we? He refuses to respond, and therefore God has to do something more drastic. And that's the same for us, brethren and sisters. We either respond to the appeal of Scripture, or God may have to do something more drastic. Come across to 2 Chronicles 33. 2 Chronicles 33 and at verse 11, the Lord brought upon them the captains of the host of the king of Assyria. Notice that. The Lord brought this particular punishment upon Manasseh. And they took Manasseh among the thorns and bound him with fetters and carried him to Babylon. Now the thorns here are either a hook through your nose or through your lips. Can you imagine that? A hook through his nose or his lips, and he's dragged off 900 kilometres to Babylon. And there in verse 12, he's in affliction. As we know, the Assyrians are very, very cruel. They oppressed him. And this feeling he has here is a very strong feeling. It's the same word used, affliction, in 2 Samuel 1 and at verse 26, to describe the feeling of David when he heard Jonathan had died. He's really under affliction, heavy affliction. They treated him very, very badly. He had the pressure of wondering, will I die today? That was the common thing they used to do, particularly the Assyrians. Now, like Samson, he's in a prison and he has time to think. And like Samson, he thought, what a fool. I had a deliberate policy to turn people away from the truth. I had wonderful opportunities. What a great start. And I destroyed it all. I knew I was doing the wrong thing. And I think this mass murderer would have had shocking, horrific nightmares of the people who he had killed. Now remember, in all of our studies, we want to go through the problem and what wrong thinking they had and what brought about the change. This is the point, the fourth point. This is the point of change. For the first time in his life, when he was in affliction, verse 12, he besought God. For the first time in his life, he properly prayed to his God. Can you believe how awkward he would feel? He'd go to God and say, God, I come unto thee acknowledging the fact that I am responsible for the death of thousands of prophets and possibly the spiritual death of my nation. I caused it all. It is my sin. What do I say to express my incredible sorrow? And he started and continued. He prayed the second time, the third time, the fourth time. And slowly he got onto the path of regular prayer. He besought. The meaning of the word besought in verse 12 is to rub, to wear. Jesenius translates it, to polish. And the only way you can rub or wear or polish is to do something over and over and over again. And that's exactly what he did. He prayed over and over and over again. But more than that, he humbled himself. It's a link to David. He's got a broken spirit. And why is his spirit broken? Because he's come to realize, as all of us need to realize, that we should be dead because of our sin. He is humbled. He is humiliated greatly. Strong's translates that vehemently or exceedingly. But God doesn't act straight away. He allows him to pray and pray and pray and pray. Why? He needs to realize how bad he has been. He needs to realize the shocking effect of sin on himself and on others. You're a murderer. Many families in Israel don't have a father or a son. You have caused so much sadness in the nation. And in verse 13, it should be he kept praying. And as he kept praying, you can imagine this man doubting, can God even hear me? Is God even listening? Oh, he was all right. In verse 13, he was entreated of him and he heard. And the word heard, according to Strong's, is he heard intelligently. His supplication, and the word supplication, according to Jesenius, is a cry for mercy. He doesn't know if his cry for mercy is going to be heard. And part of the cry for mercy is, God, if possible, release me and let me go back to my people to do what I can to undo the mess. And suddenly he's told, you can go home. The shackles are unlocked. The ring comes out of his nose or his lips and you can go home. What to do? He can be king again. Verse 13, then Manasseh knew that Yahweh was his God. The word knew is to know by experience. What a tragedy. Here is a brother who has never ever tried to have a relationship with God.
It is a brother in his whole life who's never experienced the closeness that comes when we are forgiven and our relationship with God is going okay. Hezekiah, his father, would have emphasized the important thing, Manasseh, is to develop a relationship with God. And tragically, these princes took away his confidence in God and his father, and he was convinced there's no point in worshipping such a God, and he never tried it until now. And the remarkable thing, brothers and sisters, is God forgave him. We're fairly comfortable. Look, let's be honest. We're fairly comfortable that God forgave Samson. He was a nice person. He was funny. He had a lot of good things about him. And we don't have any problems that God forgave his mistakes. And even David, we're shocked about the murder and the immorality. But even David, we think, well, look, he had so many good features. He was a lovable sort of person. We can understand why God forgave him. But when it comes to Manasseh, I have trouble accepting that fact. Here was a brother in the truth who had no redeeming features at all. There's nothing in the record you can say, oh, yeah, well, I like him. At all. And yet God still forgave him. Now he comes back to Israel. What we're about to read is a little unusual. Verse 14. After this, he built a wall without the city of David on the west side of Gihon in the valley, even at the entering of the fish gate, and compassed about Ophel and raised it to a very great high and put captains of war in all the fenced cities of Judah. So what? I mean, what would you do? You'd expect the record to say he came back and he realised his problem and he said, I've got to change the nation. I've got to get rid of idolatry. You'd imagine he'd have a huge conference to get the people to realise what they've done. No, it talks about building a wall. Why? He wants to tell everyone, I have totally changed. Before, part of my motivation was to do the exact opposite to my father. But I've changed and I now want to do everything that my father did. Come back to chapter 32 and at verse 5. He strengthened, it's talking about Hezekiah, who strengthened himself and built up all the wall that was broken and raised it up to the towers and another wall without and repaired Milo in the city of David and made darts and shields in abundance. His father was obsessed with building walls. But you know what? This is the only thing that Hezekiah started that he could not finish. He got it to a certain height, but there was a problem. There was a problem in a valley. And from an engineering point of view, it was impossible to build a high wall in a valley. Manasseh saw that and he said, "This, what I'm about to do is highly symbolic. There's something my father couldn't achieve." And he was obsessed to make sure he could come up with the answer to the problem, and he did. Quite unique to build such a high wall in a valley. I am going to be just like my father. And then verse 15, as you would expect, he took out the strange gods and the idol in the house of the Lord and all the altars that he had built in the mountain of the house of the Lord and in Jerusalem and cast them out of the city. He repairs the altar and sacrifices peace offerings and thank offerings. You would imagine that this man would offer sin offerings, as he would come to acknowledge before the people his sin. But brothers and sisters, he's already acknowledged his sin in Babylon and God has forgiven him. So now we've got a peace offering which represents the very close relationship between Manasseh and his God and a thank offering. Like David, he is overwhelmed with love and gratitude that his God is so good. And at the end of verse 16, he commanded Judah to serve. And it didn't work. Why not? You'd better get this one. The teenagers got this one as well. Exactly. They had a taste for the things of the world. For 55 years, they'd been indulging in the things of the world and they were addicted to it. That's the first reason. What's the other reason? You can't command people to serve God. They've got to want to do it because they love him. And tragically, he tried to do what he could, but his life ended up in frustration and defeat. The people didn't love him. There were too many contradictions in his life. They remembered not too many years ago he was a mass murderer. And so therefore when they bury him in his own house and not in the king's sepulchre. Brothers and sisters, he died a forgiven man. But not only that, at the end of his reign, it allowed men like Jeremiah to grow up in safety. We're going to have prophets again. And the prophets, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, had an incredible effect on the nation to get them to love God with all their heart and their mind and their soul. There's two very powerful points that come out of this session. Anyone can come back to God. Even Manasseh did. But the other point we've been emphasizing is the important work of parents. We've emphasized, as parents, and really all of us are parents, we need to minimize the corruption that the world can have upon our children. But more importantly than that, our young people have got to see the positive side of the truth. What impression are we giving to our young people about the truth? It's very important that we show to them the truth is a wonderful, positive thing. When we talk about our brethren and sisters, we emphasize the wonderful, positive things about the brethren and sisters, the wonderful, positive things the brethren and sisters do. We emphasize just how wonderful it is to come along to the meeting. We emphasize how wonderful it is to have a relationship with God. In all of our activities, brothers and sisters, we make sure that absolutely everything we do in the ecclesia can be the very best it can be. If you're a Sunday school teacher, make sure the lesson is exciting and the kids love it. If you're organising an activity, make sure it's the best that that activity can be. Young people's activities, we make sure they are the very best they can be. If you're giving a talk, brethren, make sure it can be the very best it can be. Why? So our young people don't even have to make a decision. Of course I'm going to come into the truth. I want to come into the truth. Why wouldn't I want to come into the truth? It is the best place for me. It's somewhere where I'd love to go, and it's where I want to be for the rest of my life until I die. You know, a little boy sat on Grandpa's knee. We always say to our children, don't stare when you can see something wrong. Kids always look at my belly and my balding head. And you can see the mother says, don't, that's rude. Don't, he's got something wrong with him. Don't look at him. And like all kids, this little boy would sit on Grandpa's knee and stare because there's something dreadfully wrong with Grandpa's face. He's got a hole through his nose or his lips. And at some stage, this little boy, up until age 6, would say to Grandpa, Grandpa, what's that hole in your face? And Grandpa told Josiah, Josiah, I got that because for 55 years I refused to serve God. I knew I should have served God, and because I didn't, I myself lived a life of pain and sorrow and misery which I inflicted upon the whole nation, and this hole in my face is there to remind me that I always must make sure that I have a close relationship with my God. And Josiah, when you become king, make sure your nation is a happy nation who serve God with their whole heart and mind.